This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Genesis. Please join us as Pastor Sandy teaches through Genesis chapters 7 through 10.
So he destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing, and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. That's those that had the breath of life in their nostrils. That's not the fish. The fish were in the water. People wonder, did the fish go into the ark? There were no aquariums on the ark. The fish survived in the water, but of course many of them would have died in the erosion and in the runoff and in the sediment deposits that came in the flood's aftermath. Verse 23, only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. Only Noah and those in the ark, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. Understand, it didn't matter how good of a swimmer you were. If you could do the breaststroke and the backstroke and the butterfly, none of that mattered. Do you realize that every Olympic swimmer died in the flood? Do you realize that? It didn't matter how good of a swimmer you were. Human effort, human ingenuity couldn't save you. The only folks who were saved from the flood were those who trusted in God's provision, those who came in to the ark. And the same is true for us today. This is why if you depend on your own goodness, your own merit, your own abilities, you'll drown. You'll drown in your sin. Only those who humble themselves and trust in God's promises and enter our ark, Jesus Christ, only those are the ones that will be saved. Actually, the ark is a fabulous, beautiful picture of our Lord Jesus. Think about this. The ark was a trinity. Remember, it was one boat, but there were three decks. A trinity. God was in the ark. He said, come inside. And God was also in Jesus. Both Noah and Jesus were carpenters. Isn't that interesting? And they both built a foolproof salvation, a judgment-proof salvation. When Noah entered the ark, he left behind his old life and received a new life, and the same occurs for any who put their faith in Jesus Christ. There was only one ark, and there is only one way to God. There is only one Savior. According to Genesis 6, verse 16, the ark had a single door. And guess where that door was? It was in the side of the ark. And it was out of that door that Noah came out to repopulate the earth. And likewise, it is from Jesus' side that the life-giving blood flows to repopulate heaven. And finally, the ark landed on Mount Ararat on Nisan the 17th. The 17th day of the second month, interestingly, the exact day that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. The exact day. Both events marked a new beginning for mankind. Amazing parallels between Noah's ark and our ark, Jesus Christ. Well, chapter 8 begins, then God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters receded continually from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the waters decreased. Then the ark rested in the seventh month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. The ark drifted for 5 months until it came to rest on Mount Ararat. Today, the mountain known as Ararat is a 16,254-foot peak in northeast Turkey, near the border between Iran and Armenia. And to me, it's no accident that God put the ark where he did. In fact, I believe it's still in that very same spot on Mount Ararat. God could have set the ark down in a valley, so Noah could have used it for firewood or for shelter. But instead, God put it on top of a 16,000-foot peak where it would be buried most of the time under ice and snow, I think in order to preserve it for a last day's witness. In 1840, an earthquake blew off the upper 10% of Mount Ararat. And ever since then, sightings of a large wooden man-made structure on the mountain have been reported. In 1916, a Russian pilot sighted a man-made structure on the mountain. His sighting was confirmed by two parties of soldiers in 1917. In 1943, U.S. pilots spotted this structure. In 1955, a French explorer named Fernand Navarra retrieved a piece of carved timber that was tested and dated back to 4500 B.C. Glacial ice on the mountaintop, the region's short summers, political tensions all make it difficult to access Mount Ararat and sort of thwart the expeditions, but I believe that one day undeniable proof will be presented. The skeptics of the flood, the Bible's detractors, they'll be silenced when at some point we turn up concrete evidence of the existence of Noah's Ark. Verse 5, and the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. So it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Then he sent out a raven which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up from the earth. He also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had receded from the face of the ground. You know, a raven is a scavenger, and if it finds a carcass, it'll feed off the flesh and never return. A dove, though, lands only on dry ground. And so the habits of these two birds were Noah's way of checking out how far the waters had receded on the earth. Verse 9 says, but the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, and she returned into the ark to him, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and drew her into the ark to himself. And he waited yet another 7 days. And again he sent the dove out from the ark. Then the dove came to him in the evening. And behold, a fleshly plucked olive leaf was in her mouth. And Noah knew that the waters had receded from the earth. So he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove, which did not return again to him anymore. Noah waits 7 days. There are 7-day intervals between the times that he sends out the dove. And you wonder why. Perhaps he was waiting for the Sabbath day each time. And it could be that the sending out of the dove was an expression of his faith, perhaps even a part of his worship. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, that the waters were dried up from the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry. After nearly 9 months in that ark, Noah walks out on the deck and he surveys a brand new world. Verse 14 tells us, and in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. Then God spoke to Noah, saying, go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. The same God who said, come in, now says, go out. And you know, the same is true with you and I. God calls us to come to Christ. He says, come, whosoever will may come. We come in, but after we grow and mature, we go out. The Lord instructs us to go out and to be fruitful and to spread the good news of Jesus. Now, it's interesting that Noah entered the ark on the 10th day of the second month. He exited the ark 1 year later on the 27th day of the same month. Noah was in the ark for 377 days, over a year. And here's what's important. 60% of the time was spent sitting in the same place, waiting for the waters to recede. In other words, Noah had to learn patience. Noah had to learn to wait on God, and so do you. So often we want to move, we want to go, but God says wait. We've got to learn to wait on God. The great Puritan pastor, Phillips Brooks, was pacing back and forth in the living room of his home one day when a friend came to visit. And his friend asked Brooks why he was so restless. And Phillips Brooks replied, "Because I am in a hurry and God is not." Guys, we need to learn to rest in God's promises, to allow Him to bring to pass in His time and in His way the things that He's promised to us. Remember, the word Noah, this is no accident, the word Noah means rest. Verse 17, "Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every animal, every creeping thing, every bird, and whatever creeps on the earth, according to their families, went out of the ark. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Noah's first act when he steps off of the ark onto dry ground is to build an altar to God. It's to make a sacrifice. It's to worship God. It was man's sin that had destroyed the world, but the flood didn't destroy sin. Noah's first step off of the ark was to offer a sacrifice for his sin. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Apparently, God was pleased with his sacrifice. Then the Lord said in his heart, "I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease." Even though God taught humanity a lesson, He knew that in the long run, another global judgment would be inevitable. Every human being, you see, is born with a sin nature. As verse 21 tells us, the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. God knew that judgment, again, another judgment would be necessary. But the next time, and the last judgment, the earth will be judged not with flood, but with fire. We read about that in 2 Peter and in Revelation. Well, in chapter 9, God makes a covenant with Noah suited for this post-flood world. Verse 1, "So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, on all that move on the earth, and on all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs, but you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood.'" Prior to the flood, humans were vegetarians. But after the flood, God added meat to our diet. And aren't you glad? God blessed us with Big Macs and with beef and pork barbecue. Evidently, post-flood people would need an extra source of protein, and so he added meat to our diet. And now that animals become a source of food for man, God instills in the animal kingdom a fear of humans. Verse 2 calls it a fear or a dread. Now he also says the fish of the sea have this fear and dread of man. I think that's everybody but me. I don't know of any fish that fear me. I'm a lousy fisherman. When I come walking up, they say, "Oh, great, here comes a new can of worms." But, God put a fear and a dread of man in the heart of the animals, the fish, the birds. And you see, this was God's way of sort of evening the score and protecting the animals. Imagine, you remember before the flood, this was why Noah was able to gather the animals together and put them on the ark. There was no fear between animals and man. I mean, the animals would buddy up against man. Man would buddy up against the animals. The men were vegetarians. There was no need for the two to fear each other. But after the flood, now that meat has been added to the diet, now that man becomes a predator to the animals, and the animals in turn become a predator to man. God puts this fear between us, this hostility between us. If he didn't, imagine what this would mean for the animals. It wouldn't be fair. I mean, little Bambi come walking up the path there and walks right up to me, and I reach in and pull out a few sugar cubes and feed the little deer a few sugar cubes and then blow it away with my shotgun. I mean, it would just be too easy. And so in order to sort of even the score between the humans and the animals, God put a hostility between the two. If he hadn't, it would have been an unfair advantage for the humans, hungry for meat. Well, God continues with his covenant in verse 5. Surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require it, and from the hand of man. In other words, if a pit bull mauls a young child, the dog should be put down. But that's not all. Capital punishment also applies to man, for he says, from the hand of every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. Since humans are made in God's image, murder is not just a crime against humanity. Murder is an attack on God, and therefore deserving of death. The institution of capital punishment was, in essence, God's establishment of human government. Government is God's arm to defend and to protect human life and to execute capital punishment. You remember in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus tells his followers to turn the other cheek. But he's speaking of personal relationships between people. That doesn't change the responsibilities that God gives to government. If a man kills another man, his blood should also be shed. Well, in verse 7, God instructs Noah and his descendants to go out, be fruitful, to multiply, to reproduce. He says, and as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply in it. Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, and as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. I recalled this promise this past week as Ivan flooded the streets and turned my backyard into a swimming pool. God didn't rule out isolated floods, but he did promise that a global flood would never happen again. And here are a few more lessons that we learn from Noah. We learn a lot of things from Noah. Here are a few more lessons. Don't miss the boat. Don't forget we're all in the same boat. Plan ahead. It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. Here's another lesson we learned from Noah. Stay fit. When you're 600 years old, you might just get assigned a really big job. Here's another lesson. Don't listen to your critics. Just get on with what has to be done. That's a good lesson. Build your future on high ground. For safety's sake, travel in pairs. Speed isn't always an advantage. The snails were on board with the cheetahs. When you're stressed, float a while. How about this one? The ark was built by amateurs. The Titanic was built by professionals. Remember that. Here's another lesson we learned. The woodpeckers inside are a greater threat than the storm outside. And then last, no matter the storm, when God is with you, there is a rainbow waiting. And we find that rainbow in verse 12. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in this cloud, and I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow shall be in the cloud, and I will look on it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. Here God hangs up his bow in the clouds. Of course, a rainbow is an optical phenomenon where droplets of water refract the light and create sort of a prism effect. The water reveals the total colors of the spectrum. And there were probably rainbows before the flood, perhaps in the mist that watered the Garden of Eden. You know, sometimes if you water your plants, you'll see a little rainbow in the water coming up and all. So there were probably rainbows. But since the flood was the first time that it had actually rained on the earth, no human prior to Noah had ever seen a rainbow hanging in the clouds. This was a new phenomenon. This was a sign from God. It's interesting, the Hebrew word translated rainbow literally means bow and arrow. And when God hung a rainbow in the sky, it was his way of saying that he was hanging up his bow of judgment. That judgment, that war would no longer be made toward man. The flood was over. It would never be repeated. Whenever Noah heard a clap of thunder or a bolt of lightning, he would look up and he would see God's bow in the clouds, pointed up, by the way, not down. It reminded him that God's judgment was over. The rainbow would serve as a reminder to all of humanity that God's agenda from here on out, from here to the end of the age, will be salvation, not condemnation. Verse 17, and God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." Now the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. Guys, verse 18 lists your grandpa. It does. Every one of us comes from one of Noah's my three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Take the population trends over the last century and extrapolate them back 4,500 years, and it's amazing, you end up with a total world population of 8. That's exactly what we would expect. That's how many people came off of the ark. Noah, his wife, his three sons and their wives, 8 people. It's also interesting that anthropologists group humans in basically 3 major categories: Caucasian, Negroid, and Oriental. And if you follow the genealogies of Noah's sons in chapter 10, you'll discover that they loosely parallel these 3 divisions of human beings. Japheth migrated northward into Europe and became the father of the Caucasian nations. Shem's descendants moved eastward. He birthed the Oriental and the Semitic tribes, whereas Ham's family traveled southward, and the African nations ended up being fathered by Ham. The last 10 verses of chapter 9 tell us a sad story. Noah was a man of faith and of obedience. But after walking with God for 600 years, one night does he mend. Isn't that amazing? I mean, you can be faithful for 600 years, but you can lose your reputation, put a stain on your record in just one night. And on one night, he gets drunk. He drops his guard. He figures a little wine won't hurt him. But instead of a glass or two, he gets drunk and bad things happen. Noah takes a drink. The drink takes a drink. And the drink takes Noah. Here's the first mention of wine, of alcohol in the Bible, and it leads a person to sin. You might want to take note of that. Noah may have forgotten his weakness, his need for God. Noah probably figured that he could handle a little temptation. After all, he's Noah.
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies, constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, there's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.